Getting a contact lens to take a drug up is really easy. Getting it to release it is the complicating factor.
Welcome to the OT podcast, which takes a deep dive into the topics affecting optometry today. Each time we'll find a real expert in their field and attempt to pull everything we can out of their brain so it may reside in yours. This is the 10th episode in the series and we're recording on the 4th of March 2024. You can listen to the other episodes on the OT website, on Apple or Spotify, or from your usual podcast provider. In our 10th episode, we'll be speaking to Professor Lyndon Jones. But first, I'll introduce myself. My name's Kerry Smith-Jones. I'm the Clinical Multimedia Editor for Optometry Today. And with me, as always,
Ian Beasley, Head of Education for the AOP, Clinical Editor of Optometry Today, and a visiting lecturer at Aston University. Now, Kerry, before we welcome our guest today, might just be worth having a bit of an explore around the current CPD offering that we have on the OT website. A couple of things that have caught my attention is a short but thought-provoking article on the link between sleep disorders and potential impact upon systemic and ocular disease. And I must confess, before I read that article, I didn't know a huge amount about the topic, but I found it really fascinating, actually. And then another piece to look out for is an article that takes a deep dive into the many faces of retinitis pigmentosa. And it looks at the common clinical features, but also genetic testing and also emerging treatments. How about you, Kerry?
Because I'm clinical multimedia editor, I've always got a bias towards the CPD videos, of course. So we're about to close the four steps to scleral efficiency, which is live until the 10th of May. That's Dr. Jason Jedlicker from the States, and he's talking about improving your process of scleral lens fitting. It's quite niche. It's very interesting. I learned a lot from it, so it's certainly worth a look at, especially if you're into specialty contact lenses.
And the CPD video after that is going to be an update on ocular allergy. Now, this was a lecture that we filmed at 100% Optical, and it features Damien Lake, who's a consultant ophthalmologist, who'll be taking us through the signs and symptoms, classification, immunology, and give us a review and update on the latest treatments.
And that's worth two interactive CPD points, which might be quite valuable for people at this point in the CPD cycle, of course.
So that's correct. In order to get the interactive CPD points, after you've watched the video, you answer a set of multiple choice questions as usual. You then go on to the LinkedIn discussion group, OT Interactive CPD, and you have a chat with your peers and you can present your own cases and ask questions and answer polls. And find sort of extra references and things to read about the topic. And then you write a little statement back on the OT website about what you've learnt, and then you can get your two interactive CPD points.
And we sometimes have a guest appearance from the presenter themselves, is that right? That might sort of jump into the group and help people work through some of their comments.
Yeah, it's always fantastic when the author chips in as well.
OT has run hundreds of pieces of CPD and webinars over the years, all of which are available in our online education library for AOP members and OT subscribers. You can search for any topic and learn from one of our fantastic authors, all available on the OT website. Or you can watch the latest series of OT video skills guides, which are all about domiciliary eye care, available at www.optometry.co.uk/skills-guides.
It's a real pleasure to welcome our guest today, Lyndon Jones, who's Professor at the School of Optometry and Vision Science and Director of CORE, which is the Centre for Ocular Research and Education at the University of Waterloo in Canada. Lyndon's research interests primarily focus on the interaction of novel and existing contact lens materials with the ocular environment, dry eye, and the development of novel materials for ocular drug delivery. He has authored over 450 peer-reviewed and professional papers, one textbook, and given over 1,000 invited lectures at conferences worldwide. So, Lyndon, welcome to the OT podcast. I think whenever we do these podcasts, it's always a nice place to start is at the beginning. Now, you're based in Canada now, of course, which we'll talk about a bit later on. But maybe if we can just rewind all the way back to the beginning and your time at Cardiff as an optometry undergraduate, or maybe your journey started before then, who knows?
So I was born and brought up in South Wales, so a place called Cwmbran, about 12, 30 miles away from Cardiff. Never imagined that I'd actually end up going to university. I have to say, that was never in the plan. Went through sixth form and actually became a DJ. So I was DJing in clubs in South Wales and doing all kinds of weddings and stuff. And always loved music. So always loved music from a very early age. Realised that I wasn't actually going to end up making enough money doing that. So decided, I better go to university. My A-levels weren't great. So my first go round, I didn't apply to optometry. I was actually going to do medical physics. Had a place to do medical physics in Swansea, went down to Swansea. It was the first year that they were going to run the course. And actually one of the guys there said, I don't know if I'd come into a brand new course. We're kind of not sure yet how it's going to go. So I thought, okay, well, I'll take a year off. Took that year off after sixth form, drove delivery trucks during the day, delivering sports goods, and DJed in the evening. And then thought, if I do go to university, why don't I go to Cardiff? Because if I go to Cardiff, it means that I can still work in the clubs. A mate of mine had actually gone and done optometry in Cardiff, who I was in high school with in Cumbrian. He said he was really enjoying the course. So I applied, fortunately got in. And those were in the days where Cardiff actually had a pretty small course. It might have actually been the smallest course in the UK at the time. There was only 30 students. What's really interesting is, so of the 30 students who started, 28 finished. And of those 28, interesting group, because three of us ended up doing PhDs. So, 10% of the class doing a PhD. So in my year was Fiona Stapleton, who I still see very regularly. She did a pre-reg at Moorfields and then went on and did a PhD in the UK and then went out and ended up being head of department in Sydney and still lives in Sydney in Australia. Dave Adams was in our year, who ended up doing his PhD at the time in something that wasn't very sexy, but it certainly is now, and that's kind of myopia progression. He was one of the earliest people to look at myopia progression in, I think he actually did it in microscopists. So looking at the impact of doing microscopy on myopia. So he did his PhD with Neville McBrien, then ended up spending almost 40 years in the hospital eye service, recently retired from Plymouth, with someone else ended up doing a master's, Andy Millington, who was in our year. So he was my roommate, actually, in first year in optometry. He's now on faculty at the new Faculty of Health and Applied Sciences Optometry School at UW Bristol. So he worked for a number of years at Cardiff in the special needs clinic with Maggie Woodhouse. So we had three of us do PhDs, one end up going into hospital optometry forever and a day. And then we had some go to industry as well. So Guy Whittaker, who was also in our year, who ended up working for Essilor and then Ocular Sciences, and then ended up being VP of Global Marketing for Cooper Vision and recently retired from there. So from a really small bunch of people, 28 people, to end up with that was fantastic. And my time at Cardiff was amazing. The lectures we had there were just absolutely fantastic.
When you started that optometry course, were you sort of almost resentful that you were leaving behind the DJ career, or did you just get stuck into it and thought, well, this is for me?
Well, I ended up DJing actually all throughout the time I was at Cardiff. And the last gig that I actually did was just before I moved to London. So I ended up moving to London to do my pre-reg. I was the LRH pre-reg, or one of the two LRH pre-regs, when I finished at Cardiff. And so the last weekend that I was in Cardiff before I moved to London was the last gig that I did. Still love music. I still sing in a band now. So the band that I sing in has been the band at a couple of quite a few BCLA events and American Academy events. So yeah, still listen to music every single day. So still love music, all kinds of.
Something you share in common with Kerry, who's currently in her studio.
Oh, right. What sort of music are you into, Kerry?
I play bass, play flute as well, do the backing vocals because I was the alto and a choir at school. So, being Welsh, we were brought up singing. So.
And that's why I ended up singing in a band. When I moved to Canada, John Flanagan, who was on faculty here, who'd known me since I was a kid, had seen me sing at various weddings. And, my grandfather was in a male voice choir, and, that's what you just do. You just sung, and I still sing at karaoke stuff now whenever I'm around the world. You go to Japan and everyone says, oh, I know you sing. Let's go and do karaoke. So yeah, I still love music. Yeah, so that was at the end of my optometry time in Cardiff. Absolutely loved my time there. It was just brilliant time. So we had fantastic lecturers there. Was fortunate enough to get the LRH pre-reg position, moved to London.
LRH is that now what's Institute of
the
Optometry?
Institute of Optometry, yeah. So the London Fraction Hospital that became the Institute of Optometry. So there'll be enough old people listening, I'm sure, that remember the old London Refraction Hospital. But yeah, to everyone new now, it's the Institute of Optometry. Again, was very fortunate to have just fantastic people who educated me about, you know, how to be a really good clinician. So Keith Edwards, Jeff Robeson, Nairi Franklin, Judy Morris, Ron Mallett. It was just a fantastic time to be at the LRH. And so when I finished my pre-reg, I actually stayed on. So I actually stayed on 2 days a week at the LRH, spent 4 days a week in practice and 2 days a week at the LRH, would work a couple of evenings at the LRH as well to see some of the external clinicians. And again, just that time being in Cardiff and really understanding the importance of research to clinical practice, and then being at the LRH and understanding how important it is to be a really, really good clinician. And it's interesting, actually, having been over here now, I'm sure we'll move on to the differences between UK and North American optometry. What I see in North American optometry is this, you know, real move towards the importance of ocular disease and understanding disease and treating disease, which is absolutely critical. I'm very much a believer in expanding the scope of optometry. But I worry whether we've moved away from the importance of what optometry does, which is pediatrics, doing a good refraction, contact lenses, binocular vision. I think we've kind of downgraded the relevance and importance of those to disease. And yet, you know, in clinical practice, if we see 3 or 4% of our patients with ocular disease that you can actively manage, that's unusual. It's probably less than that. Whereas the vast majority of our patients need a good refraction. They need to be dispensed well. You need to be able to understand the importance, I think, of binocular vision. Was probably one of the last people, along with Bruce Evans, to actually do a deorth. So I did my DCLP and deorth, and again, those really helped where I am now. Although I'm not in clinical practice now, they really helped me, I think, to understand the importance of those basics of optometry to research and the impact that has on practice and how it goes round.
You then ended up in my neck of the woods at Aston some few years later, which is where you did your PhDs.
That's right. And again, you know, if someone had ever said to me that you're going to do a PhD, I'd have said, you must be kidding. Like, there's not a chance. Anyone who would have known me going through school, my A-levels were not great. You know, I got two Bs and a C at A-level. I'd never get into optometry school these days. Never in a million years. Not a chance I'd gain. And the PhD thing was interesting because that came about kind of really by accident and to some extent through Judy Morris, who was my kind of contact lens guru at the LRH at the time. And she gave me the opportunity to really kind of start getting involved in research because we'd have quite a lot of clinical trials going through the LRH. And this was at the time when disposable lenses were just coming through. So how I was splitting my time was between being in clinical practice and the practice I worked in, which I eventually ended up buying into, did a lot of contact lenses. So the practice in Sidcup in Kent, it was Collett's Opticians, and was originally a jeweler optician. It had actually opened in 1897 and it had been fitting contact lenses since the 70s. So we had an awful lot of rigid contact lens patients. And when I started working there in late 1986, that was just as the Acuvue disposal lens system was coming in. We were kind of trying to move towards high water contact lenses and disposable contact lenses. And J&J brought out the Acuvue system that, you know, was originally being used for 1 week overnight wear, and then it got moved when people started to get complications to 2 weeks replacement on a daily wear basis. But you'd see some of these patients who, you know, why should they be replaced in 2 weeks? And we started to have high water contact lenses come through, and you'd see all kinds of weird deposits, you know, these lipid deposits, the lens calculi, and we didn't know how to clean them because the solutions that we had at the time were really only peroxide or preserved systems. It was just at the time where Bausch & Lomb was bringing through its Renew system that was preserved with PHMB, and then we saw Alcon coming through with the polyquad preserved systems, the early Optifree systems. And so there was a lot of things happening all at the same time. New materials, new solutions, all kinds of problems that you'd see with these new materials. And Judy got me in touch with a chemical engineer at Aston University called Brian Tai. And Brian had published a lot of stuff on deposits in the sort of early to mid 80s before disposable lenses came through. And I was very fortunate to have a conversation. J&J had just started setting up its professional services system in the UK. And Ian Davis, who had worked for Allergan prior to that, was their first professional services guy. I'd known him for quite a few years. We'd lectured a couple of times together. And just one day I said to him, you know what? It'd be great if we had some idea of what drives these deposits and how often lenses should actually be replaced. And it was like, oh, I might be able to get some funding for you for that, J&J, if you're interested. And it was like, okay, well, I think I know someone who could be my supervisor. So bizarrely, I made an appointment with Brian Tai, walked into his office, and he kind of looked at me as if to say, okay, so you're a clinician. You're coming to do a PhD in chemical engineering. You've got a project. You've got money. This doesn't kind of happen very often. I guess I'll take you on as a student. So I started my PhD purely because of something I'd noticed in clinic. It sparked me to think, I think we could probably know better about this and we need some basic understanding of this. And so I very fortunately then was funded by J&J and did my PhD part-time with Brian. So I spent 2 days a week up in Aston, lived down in London. So 4 days a week I was in practice, 2 days a week I switched my LRH days for 2 days a week at Aston. And again, Brian was fantastic. Brian and Ian were, you know, two great mentors again to be able to kind of let me work through questions and bouncing stuff around. And Brian at the time had an incredible variety of PhD students. He actually had 16 PhD students all at the same time, which is very unusual. I mean, just supervising that number of students is a nightmare. I know because I've actually done 14 at a time and I'll never, ever do that again. It's a nightmare. But what's really interesting in working with Brian is that every single person had a different background. There wasn't one person who had the same background. So the lab was brilliant. See, I was the only clinician, so I'd go there and I'd have all these, you know, really stupid questions, and they'd have questions about a clinical thing. And when we met, it was awesome. So that was again a fabulous time in my development as a scientist to be able to really, I mean, that concept around a clinician scientist, which is really what I am. I'm first and foremost a clinician who happens to you know be involved now and working in an academic unit. So. At the end of doing my PhD, I had to make a decision about either staying in private practice, moving to industry, because the practice had done a lot of clinical trials with industry, so I was very used to working with industry, or moving to academia. It was actually Brian who said to me one day, don't go back into practice. You can always go back into practice. Why don't you try industry or academia? And someone had just approached him, actually, a couple of weeks prior to this conversation and said, oh, there's an academic position going in, it was Berkeley at the time. You know, why don't you apply for it? It's like, me working in a university? No, that's never going to happen. And talked it over with my wife, Debbie, and she went, you know what? Why don't we just give it a go? So we sent our CV off. I didn't get that position. And we sent our CVs off around the world, and she got offered a position in one place. I didn't, and vice versa. And the first place that actually offered us two faculty positions was Waterloo. So, you know, we came for the interviews, and Canada doesn't really tell people much about it. You know, all I knew about Canada was snow and mounties, and that was pretty much it. It's great for skiing. I think they've got great mountains, but I don't know much else about it. Came out for the interviews, was blown away by just how much space there is here, how friendly everyone was, how safe it is, how actually quite different it is to the US. I've been to the US many, many times to go to various conferences. And, you know, and I remember one of the questions I asked at the interview was, so what's the gun stuff like here? Like, you know, is it going to be safe to live here? And everyone around the table just laughed and went, we don't have guns here. Like, they have guns for hunting, but no one carries guns. It's not like the US. So that was a bit of a revelation. And so we ended up moving it. So, and again, I never imagined that would happen, because back in 1991, when we bought into the practice, these two practices, one in Sidcup and one in Eltham in Southeast London, Debbie and I had bought in as partners to these two well-established practices, two brothers who were in their 50s who were kind of looking to move out of their practice. And one of their sons was a dispensing optician. So we went into partnership with him, bought the two practices, and had this massive amount of debt, decided that we needed, because the practices were quite old, we decided that we were going to revamp the practices. So we refit them. Very fortunately, you know, we ran a lot of open days and we had great staff, and actually ended up winning a couple of optician awards. So between 1995 and 1997, we won the overall contact lens practice of the year twice, overall practice once, and overall marketing practice once as well. So these are big practices. We saw about 35,000 patients a year in between the two practices. So we're as far as we were concerned, we're very well set that we were, you know, that's what we're going to do. We were going to be in practice for the rest of our life, but not to be. So I moved here in 98, was very fortunate to join the Centre for Contact Lens Research, the CCLR, which was run by the inaugural director, Des Fon, who very kindly gave me the opportunity to basically open up a new branch of CCLR. CCLR started in 1988 doing clinical trials. It was one of the biggest clinical trial units in the world. It was, you know, very involved in contact lens comfort, contact lens discomfort and dropout, disposable lenses, presbyopia, torics, and Des really had this incredible group of people doing fantastic clinical research. But it didn't have a lab. It didn't have a biological sciences lab. And because I'd done my PhD in chemical engineering, I was used to working in a lab. And his challenge was, okay, you know, when we do these clinical trials and we know that lens A turns out to be better than lens B, or solution A turns out to be better than solution B, why is it? You know, is there a way that we can set up some biological sciences work to be able to kind of better understand why those things happen? And so that was my challenge. So my challenge was I came in as a faculty member, taught ocular disease, contact lenses, some of the ocular therapeutics as well. So that was my faculty job, but my research job was really setting up these wet labs for CCLR. And then when Des retired in 2011, I'd been his associate director for a number of years, was fortunately being given the opportunity to take over as director of CCLR. And we've grown it since that point. And we're now up to about, it varies depending upon how many students we've got, but somewhere between 40 and 50 people. So we're the biggest university-based research group doing contact lens and dry eye research. We've got kind of these three groups of people: the researchers, the support staff to help with the clinical trials, and the graduate students and the postdocs. And we've got these three platforms. So we now have the original clinical trials platform, we've got the biological sciences platform, and then we've got the education platform as well. So the education platform takes all the information from the other two platforms and basically pushes it out. What's interesting over the years, again, is you know, the typical academic way of getting information out is through peer review papers. The problem is clinicians don't have the time, or indeed sometimes the inclination to be able to read those research papers. They don't have access often to the journals. And so we spend a lot of time actually within our education arm actually publishing stuff in clinical journals. So Optician, Optometry Today, Review of Cornea and Contact Lenses, Spectrum, where we kind of disseminate that high-level information in a way that's more kind of discernible and kind of bite-sized for clinicians. As well, more recently, we've started to use social media as well. So social media is certainly a way that I think younger clinicians like to get their information. So not so much through Facebook, but things like Twitter and LinkedIn for more professional publications as well. So I think you need to be a little bit different these days in academic to what you used to be able to disseminate that information.
I think one of my favorite emails that I get that I subscribe to is the contact lens update. That comes from Cork, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. So that actually morphed. Yeah. So when silicone hydrogels were coming out, Des Fon came with this idea of the fact that, you know, there's so much information coming out about silicone hydrogels. How do you keep on top of this stuff? And how do you, again, keep clinicians up to date with the kind of latest, greatest information? So he was fortunate to get funding from CBVision at the time to launch a website called siliconhydrogels.org. And that was amazing. We basically pumped out so much information through siliconhydrogels.org. And then as that kind of wave started to disappear, we changed it from siliconhydrogels.org to Contact Lens Update. Contact Lens Update is fortunately funded by J&J, Alcon, and Cooper Vision. We push out 6 issues per year. I'm glad you'll enjoy that, Kerry. That's good to hear.
It provides the information in a succinct way, and exactly that. I can't read every peer-reviewed journal that comes out. And if something particularly catches my eye, I'll click the link and I might go and read an abstract. But it's just the fact you do make it quite succinct. There's not a lot of fluff around it as well. It's just really useful.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Kerry. That really means a lot, the fact that you know, the majority of our readers are actually from North America, but we get a lot of European subscribers to it. We also now get subscribers from the Far East and from South America, South Africa. So it is a global publication, but it is nice to hear. And you know, it's tough for these companies to actually keep continuing to support this. We've just actually gone into, it's our 14th year actually, this year, starting contact lens update. So we've been going for a long period of time, and it's tough to keep it fresh. And, you know, for these companies to be able to keep supporting things like contact lens update is hard, because there's continual pressure on them to, how can they best use their funds to be able to support educational opportunities. So that's great that that you like that.
And then the BCLA seems to be taking a similar approach with their things like the CLEAR reports, which you've, yes, you've fed into it.
The first concept behind doing these sort of multi-institutional publications really came from TIFOS. The Tearfilm and Ocular Surface Society first started doing these really big reports back with the Dewes reports. So the original Dewes report back in 1997. Then it did the, you know, the meibomian gland dysfunction report, it did the contact lens discomfort report. Then it did Dewes 2 back in 2017. We're just about to start Dewes 3 now. So we had our first meeting on Dewes 3 actually in Sydney in January of this year. So, you know, we'll see Dewes 3 coming out next year. So TIFOS really kind of nicely put that concept together of having global experts work on a variety of papers. Since that time, we've seen BCLA jump on that concept and do a really nice job with the BCLA CLEAR reports. It's coming out with its BCLA CLEAR presbyopia report later this year. That'll be really, you know, well received. So I was fortunate to be involved in that with James Wolfson. We've seen the IMI do the IMI reports on myopia management. So, you know, those three organizations, I think, have done a really great job of being able to, again, take all of the global information and produce peer-reviewed consensus reviews using the available information around at the time. And they're a great summary for people to, you know, where is the state of the art at the moment? So I've been fortunate to be involved in all three of those. I'm on the organizing committee for, I'm on the board of directors for TIFOS, and I've been involved in the IMI reports and the BCLA CLEAR report. So yeah, those are not run through CORE. They're just my involvement and other members of our team as being involved in that. And yeah, you mentioned, Ian, actually about CORE, the name CORE, you know, really followed on from CCLR. So, say CCLR, Centre for Contact Lens Research, was started in 1988 by Des. When I took over in 2011, we kind of expanded a little bit more into other areas, things like ocular drug delivery that we weren't particularly involved in before. Myopia control has certainly become a big deal since then, not just around contact lenses. So what we started to realise was that the name Centre for Contact Lens Research really kind of didn't cover the kind of stuff that we were doing. So in 2018, we actually renamed ourselves and rebranded ourselves as CORE, the Centre for Ocular Research and Education, which is what we are now. Not because we're doing different things than when we were CCLR, it's just the name better reflects how CCLR has evolved into an organisation that does more than just contact lens research.
And you preempted a question that, about Dewes and when we'd expect Dewes 3 and any sneak preview of what it might hold, or is it too early to say?
We probably ought to clarify, just for there might be some people who aren't used to the acronym, that Dewes is the dry eye workshop.
And this will be the third report, hence Dewes 3. It is too early. So literally the planning committee had its first meeting the first week of January of this year. It will be scaled down, so there won't be as many reports as there have been in previous ones. So in previous ones, we've had sort of 8 or 9 reports. This time we're primarily going to really have 3 CORE reports. That's going to be a diagnostic report, which will also look at the definition as well. So do we need to modify the definition? So that'll be the diagnostic report. Then there'll be a management and therapy report, which is the report that I'm chairing. And then there'll be a kind of a digest. The digest will be all of those other reports updated with what's the latest information on pathophysiology, epidemiology, any of those areas that were covered in the other reports in one single report. So the diagnostic report is being chaired by James Wolfson. I'm doing the management and therapy, and Fiona Stapleton's doing the digest report. And then we have a group of other people, including people like Jennifer Craig, who's involved as well in terms of the overall organisation of Dewes 3. But Dewes 3, I've actually got a meeting tomorrow night, in fact, with my management therapy committee, which will be the first time that all of my committees actually met. So we're very, very early in the process at the moment. We're just putting together the outline of what that report will look like. And we're hoping to have it published sort of the first quarter probably of 2025 would be when we're likely to see Dewes 3 out.
And then if we just talk about life in Canada, I mean, you touched on this earlier on, saying when you arrive, you're just blown away by the space and how safe it feels. I mean, does that still hold true today? Is that, you know, do you miss the UK, or you just didn't ever dream of coming back?
I do. I mean, I do miss the UK in terms of I miss rugby, I miss cricket, I miss English pubs, and I miss Marks and Spencer's food hall. We don't have those sort of ready meal stuff that you can get now. And, you know, I was recently over in the UK about 5 weeks ago. And, you know, whenever you go to Marks and Spencer's or Sainsbury's or anything, those sort of ready meals that you can get in the evening that are just absolutely fantastic if you're rushed. We don't have those in Canada. You have tons of fresh food, but those things that you can just grab. And I really miss curries as well. We don't have good curries here. So I fortunately do get my UK fix of food, sport, and old buildings. We don't have old buildings here either. So I was in London doing some recording, and it was wonderful wandering around about old buildings again. That was fantastic. So, but I do get my fix because I usually come across the UK a couple of times a year. And of course, you miss friends and family for sure. But Canada's a pretty great place to live. You know, the winter sucks. I mean, it is flipping cold. You know, it's not unusual for us to have snow on the ground from kind of second or third week of November through to the first week of April. Although global warming is having an impact, typically at this time of year, we'd be about minus 15 or so with snow on the ground. And I'm looking out my window and it's a beautiful sunny day. It's about plus 10. I think it's going up to about plus 13 or 14 later on today. And we've got no snow on the ground. So global warming is definitely having an impact. But apart from the cold winter, you know, when it can go down to minus 30, that's without the wind chill. So they post the flesh freezing times in the mornings, which are because what's another interesting fact, kids here have to go out for at least half an hour a day outside unless it goes below minus 17. If it goes below minus 17, they don't have to go out, but otherwise they do. So I remember when our kids, our daughter was about three when we moved here, or three and a half actually, and our son was just born here. We just moved here when Debbie gave birth to Ben. And so these kids, you know, you put them in these full body suits with, you know, full masks, and they go outside, and of course they always want to have a pee. So you've just put them outside and it's like, oh, I told you, did you want to go for a pee? But then you've got to get them back in and take all the snow suit off and stuff. And because it's so cold, you literally have to tape on their gloves onto their coat, because if the coat comes off, they'll get frostbite. So there are definitely some strange things about living in Canada. But the people are great, very, very friendly, and there is so much space, it's crazy. And you know, house prices when we moved here were just so cheap. They've definitely gone up now in Waterloo, but again, just the cost of living is certainly much, much lower than it is living in the UK, for sure.
And how about optometry? What's it like being a primary care optometrist in Canada?
It's interesting, actually, how there is this big fixation about disease, for sure, the expansion of scope of practice. You know, optometry is different here in that optometry in North America is a second degree. So just like medicine, dentistry, veterinary science, you do a primary undergraduate degree in science. So that's 3 or 4 years. And then you do your professional degree. Optometry is a four-year program, 3 years at the university, and then your fourth year, you do a fair proportion of that away from the university. The only clinics that we have our fourth years in is our specialty clinics. So they'll come into the pediatrics clinic and the ocular disease clinic and the contact lens clinic. But much of their training is actually done in clinical practices. And there is definitely that, you know, great interest in terms of recognition, management of disease. We have a large amount of our time spent on disease and also ocular therapeutics. So when you graduate, it's not a postgraduate diploma. You're fully graduate with the ability to do ocular therapeutics. So you have a full scope of practice. That varies depending upon the province that you're in Canada, in terms of what you can do. But I have a full, you know, ability to be able to use. You can use orals. You can use pretty much any topical that's available. So depending upon where you are in Canada, in Alberta, you can do minor surgical procedures. If you go on another course, so that is a postgraduate course. But we educate basically in Canada to the same level that we do in the US, because the board exams are effectively the same. So it is different doing primary care here. It is interesting how, you know, certainly I think since the pandemic, I think we're seeing more and more patients deciding to order things like their contact lenses and their spectacles online. And I think that's going to continue to expand. And I think if I was a young practitioner setting up private practice today, I'd be looking to make my practice a specialized practice. I would want to pick something where people have to come and see me. And I would look at things like dry eye. You know, the opportunities in dry eye diagnosis and management these days are enormous. We're seeing a huge number of drugs in the pipeline to treat dry eye disease, as well as a significant number of new devices that are now available. So I would look at dry eye. I would certainly look at specialty contact lenses. You know, if anyone had said to me, oh yeah, you'll be fitting scleral lenses and they'll be, you know, like perfectly normal. I remember doing my DCLP where you had to fit, you know, part of that you had to do a scleral. So that was back in the late 80s when I did my DCLP. And, you know, you did it using an impression method and it took you forever to fit a patient with a scleral lens. The fact that now we do scleral contact lens research here and our fourth year students are regularly fitting scleral lenses and doing it quite comfortably. So I would look at specialty contact lenses, ortho K, myopia control would be another area. You know, the opportunity to control the progression of myopia. You have such great methods of being able to do that now. And in fact, interesting, my wife, Debbie, who's UK trained optometrist on faculty here as well, that she does most of our, her particular area of research is myopia control. And she actually worked with the Canadian Association of Optometrists to actually develop a set of guidelines where we are the first organization in the world, the first country, to actually have myopia control as standard of care. So the Canadian Association of Optometrists now state that, through the guidelines that Debbie put together, that myopia control is standard of care, and that's fantastic. So, yeah, I would look at specialty contact lenses, myopia control, dry eye, and be really good at seeing old people and kids. You know, be good at binocular vision, be good at pediatrics, and you're always going to be in demand. I think if we only concentrate on wanting to look at disease, and I'd say I'm very pro expanding our scope of practice, but not at the expense of what we need to be good at. I think that's in addition to rather than instead of.
We wanted to talk to you about some of your research interests, and especially the idea of that's coming, medicated contact lenses. I notice, you know, you can now get an AcuView disposable lens with ketotifen. I don't think it's yet available in the UK. Is that something you're doing in Canada? And what else is coming in that pipeline?
If we look at the areas of research that CORE is primarily involved in these days, it continues to be in the areas of contact lenses. And if I look at the areas that it's expanded into, it is into the areas of specialty contact lenses. There is a lot of interest these days in certainly scleral lenses. So we have a couple of our researchers who are experts on scleral contact lenses. We're also very involved in myopia control, whether that be pharmaceutical, whether it be ortho-K, soft contact lenses, or spectacles. We're fortunate here in Canada that we do have spectacles, unlike the US. The US doesn't yet have any approved spectacles for myopia control. So that's a big miss. It will happen. The approvals are being sought at the moment, but we've had spectacles now in Canada for a number of years. So clinicians have been using that for a long period of time. In terms of, if I look at the contact lens areas, the areas that we're particularly involved in terms of contact lens research relate to still the age-old problem of trying to make contact lenses comfortable. We're still finding that patients want to be able to wear their lenses for longer and sadly can't. You know, we're still looking at 50% of patients complaining of dryness and discomfort with their contact lenses towards the end of the day. So we're very involved in working with industry on that, and some of that may well be involved in the thing you just talked about, Kerry, with respect to things like medicated or release of agents from contact lenses. And so we saw with Johnson & Johnson bringing out its Theravision lens that we now have a commercially available drug delivery contact lens. That lens is actually approved for use in only three areas at the moment. It's approved in Japan, the US, and Canada, but it's actually only commercially available in Canada. So we have practitioners being able to prescribe Acuity Theravision and have had for a couple of years. And the practitioners who use it say how useful it is in the management of their patients with allergic eye disease. So those are primarily contact lens patients who have allergic eye disease who have to discontinue their contact lenses during the time when they get their allergy flares. That certainly has been very useful. But that concept, I think, of being able to deliver a drug to your eye from a contact lens has got a lot of legs. If we look at drops, you know, when you look at patients who manage their ocular disease, or indeed when they manage things like dry eye, you've got to remember to put drops in. That has a couple of problems. First of all, you've got to remember to put it in. Secondly, you've got to be good at putting it in. And some patients are not. You know, they'll end up with half of the drop actually coming down their cheek. And we know in cases like glaucoma, for example, even where patients know that they are going to lose vision if they don't put their anti-glaucoma drops in, compliance is only about 50%. And so being able to deliver a therapeutically relevant amount of drug to your eye through a contact lens is, interestingly, actually, if you look at the original patent that Otto Victorli brought out in 1960, one of the things he said in that original patent was these contact lenses could be used for ocular drug delivery. So Otto Victorli thought about that right back in 1960, 1961. Fast forward to 2021, so 50 years later, and J&J bring out the world's first ocular drug delivery contact lens. So, you know, it's not easy to do. It sounds easy, but it's not. We've actually been working on ocular drug delivery since about 2002. And we have a number of graduate students as well as postdocs working on those. But again, just think about delivery of a dry eye product to your eye. How cool would that be? You know, because we still have a lot of patients with ocular dryness, being able to deliver a comfort agent from a contact lens and making those contact lenses comfortable. Myopic control. We have a significant number of patients who use soft contact lenses to slow the progression of their myopia, but the degree to which they respond to that, their efficacy response, is not as good as you would like. Imagine incorporating into that a low-dose atropine into the lens. So if you had a low-dose atropine lens, you've got the optical correction that we know works, as well as the low-dose atropine that we know works. You know, put those two together, it's magic. So there is a lot of interest in that.
And what makes it difficult to do? Is it the stability of the drug? Is it the release of the drug in a consistent way, or all of the above?
Getting a contact lens to take a drug up is really easy. Getting it to release it is the complicating factor. First of all, if you use silicon hydrogels and the drug is relatively hydrophobic, which a lot of drugs of interest are, then the hydrophobic domains within the silicon hydrogel lens hold onto it. So you put a lot of drug in and not much comes out. You've got to control how it is that you can trigger that release. The next thing is if you take a hydrogel lens, which actually does deliver a drug really easily, which is why J&J came out with the Acuvue 2 material, the Etifilcon material. It's a hydrogel material, not a SiHy, but because it's primarily water, its release actually is very effective. The problem is you get a burst release. So you get this dump release into your eye, and that's not what you want. What you want is a controlled release of that drug from the lens. So with silicone hydrogels, the difficulty is releasing it because it holds onto it. With hydrogels, the difficulty is controlling the release because it releases too much. So it's that sweet spot between those two, a little bit like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You know, you want that nice little sweet spot, and that's what's proven to be difficult. So researchers and companies have spent a lot of time trying to look at that targeted release such that you get that therapeutically relevant amount. To some extent, they've now done that. So the next challenge now is actually being able to produce them at a reasonably low cost compared with drops. And then secondly, keeping the drug active, because the drug actually goes off. So you need to, you know, the shelf life that you have that drug active for is, again, not the shelf life that you get with a regular contact lens. So there are definitely some challenges. And it may well be that actually it's not necessarily the big guys. It's not the J&Js, the Alcons, the B&Ls of this world, the Cooper Visions, that are necessarily the ones who are going to bring those to market. I think it's probably going to be some more niche companies who are probably going to be better set up to be able to bring those to market. In addition to that, we've certainly got some interest in electronic contact lenses. So the ability of contact lenses to work as a head-up display. You know, Mojo Vision became very, you know, very sexy and managed to raise a lot of money, have since got out of that and have gone into just making high-definition displays. But having contact lenses as head-up displays and being able to change their prescription to be used for something like a presbyopic contact lens. Imagine having a presbyopic contact lens that actually gave you back your ability to focus that you had when you were in your 20s. I'm 61 now, and I'm sick to... Presbyopia is a disease, it really is. I remember those two practitioners that we bought into, Mike and Jim Collett, who were in their 50s at the time, when I first graduated and went into the practice, them saying, you know, you can't have empathy with a presbyope until you actually have our presbyopic. And you're thinking, I could be empathetic. I'm a very empathetic chap. No, you don't understand presbyope until you're presbyopic. They were bang on. They were absolutely right. And so presbyopia is definitely a challenge that I think electronic contact lenses will certainly help us with, for sure.
And how about in terms of the ability of contact lenses to detect systemic disease? Is a thing that may have been touched upon in the BCLA CLEAR reports.
That's right, the CLEAR report that, again, I was involved in that kind of future contact lens report. Yeah, I mean, the ability of a contact lens to be able to detect systemic disease, you know, probably the area that's been most looked at there is diabetes. So because we have glucose levels in our tear film that mirror the amount that we have in our blood with a delay of about 20 minutes or so, a lot of interest in terms of doing that. But I think we've kind of gone past that. I think we have better ways of being able to measure glucose now with these automatic glucose sensors that are, you know, used interstitial. At the time when that was being looked at, those weren't available. So I think that's probably not really ever going to come to market. I'll be surprised if that ever does. Being able to look at other systemic diseases, recognition of things, you using AI and electronic contact lenses to look at things, changes in your retina associated with things like Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases. There's a lot of interest in terms of looking at that at the moment. There are also other biomarkers within the tear film, things like cancer, other markers that aren't glucose related, relating to things like diabetes, that people are looking at. So certainly there is people working on looking at systemic disease, but probably ocular disease is easier. We already have a commercially available electronic contact lens that measures your intraocular pressure indirectly, the Sensimed Triggerfish lens out of Switzerland. And so that's been able to show us that we can do that to look at intraocular pressure. And there's a couple of other groups, one in Dubai and one in Korea, who are fairly well advanced in terms of looking at other intraocular pressure measurement methods. So I think, again, there certainly is a huge amount of interest, a lot of IP being developed, you know, a significant number of patents that have come out over the last 5 years or so, looking at contact lenses for use in the diagnosis of disease. But I think we're probably more likely to have ocular disease detection before we have systemic disease detection.
So do you think we're going to be seeing something completely new in contact lenses? Because we had hydrogels and then silicone hydrogels came out. And if neither of those are suitable, particularly for drug delivery, are we going to see something completely different? Are we going to have another revolution?
Well, that's a great question, Kerry. And certainly... We've been looking for that for a while. It's really interesting, actually. If you look at the numbers of abstracts at major meetings like EVA in Europe, like ARVO in the US, the American Academy meeting, you look at those meetings and the numbers of abstracts around basic contact lens stuff are pretty rare these days. The numbers of abstracts have definitely dropped. Unless you're into specialty contact lenses, unless you're into myopia control, there's not a huge new thing that's come through for quite a while. You know, we had the hydrogels, then we had high water content hydrogels, then we had disposables, then we had daily disposables, then we had silicone hydrogels, then we had daily disposable silicone hydrogels. And that's kind of now, I think, come to about as far as it's going to go. There's not a huge amount, I think, of innovation still to come around the basic materials. Now, I think what we'll see is modifications of those in terms of either surface modifications to make them more comfortable and to be able to allow tears to spread over them better. If you look at the length of time that the tear film remains stable on your eye compared with the length of time it remains stable over a contact lens, there's a massive mismatch. You know, over your cornea, the tear film remains stable for 20, 25 seconds. Over a contact lens, it's 6 to 7 seconds. Now, that's a big difference. Now, the very bulk of that lens doesn't help, but we should be able to develop a surface that actually encourages that tear film to remain more stable and more adherent to that for a longer period of time. And that's going to give us two benefits. One is going to be more comfortable, and secondly, we're going to get better vision. because as that tear film ruptures, you get a disturbance in the visual performance of that lens as well. So I think we're going to see better surfaces, and I think we're going to see those lenses releasing things that encourage comfort. So I think that will probably be what happens, as opposed to a whole new family of materials. You know, the contact lens companies have been trying to develop something that's better than a silicon hydrogel for a number of years, at least a decade. And it's hard. It's hard because whatever novel material you make or that you find, whilst it might be great in terms of transmitting oxygen, it may not necessarily provide a lens that's completely transparent. Well, there's kind of a bit of a rate limiting factor there. And so, you know, some of the areas that we've been looking at that aren't necessarily around contact lens materials, but maybe for the management of dry eye, relate to things like triggered release from maybe ocular inserts. You know, maybe you can pop something underneath your lower lid that actually gets triggered by either your body temperature or by something within your tears that actually releases things. So I know that's not a contact lens, but it certainly relates to the management of dry eye. So that's some of the things that we've been looking at. But a whole new family of contact lens materials that has as broad a range of success as silicon hydrogel, I think that's going to be a tough one to be quite
honest. Lyndon, I think that's a great place to end our time with you today. So thank you so much for giving up your time. It's been fascinating hearing about the whole story from the DJing, which I wasn't expecting, right the way through to the sort of weird and wonderful technologies that are perhaps heading our way.